to do. If I had come to Alcoholics Anonymous and no one had ever paid any attention to me, I had no feeling of pride in my life. I had no ego left at all. It would have been better if I'd had a little ego. But I had no self-respect. I was filled with shame and remorse. I felt I couldn't tell anyone there my story. And there weren't any women to talk to. And eventually it nearly killed me because I had so much bottled up, and I called Frank Randall and talked to him, and Cliff Walker, and I talked to him. Because at my very first meeting, they put me in charge of the women, and the women came in droves. Well, how could I go to one of these new people and say, look, I have a terrible problem, and you know, I want you to solve it for me or help me solve it. I couldn't do it. I was a very shy person. I couldn't talk at meetings. I couldn't participate. I couldn't, a mic, I think it would have killed me. I think a microphone would have absolutely killed me. And I went on like that for months, and my brother Tex was sober, and he said, you're stubborn, Sib. You're my sister. I know you. You're going to stay sober forever. But you're going to be a miserable human being because you will not participate in any way in AA. Yeah, you make 12-step calls, but you won't participate. You haven't stood up in any downtown one night. You got up and gave your name because Frank Randall said, we have a woman now that's been sober 4 months. Stand up, Sybil. And I did. And I said, my name is Sybil. I've been sober 4 months. And I sat down. And I didn't sleep for a week. It nearly killed me. And Tex said, you got to get over it. You've got to participate like the others because it's a hole in the ground. Everybody talked. Everybody talked. And finally one night he said, I'm going to fix it this way and I'm going to try it just this once and it's got to work. Now we're going to go down there before a human being comes along. And then, as John comes in, you say, hello, John. And when Mary comes in, say, hello, Mary. They're friends of yours. You've known them from the day they got sober. And pretty soon there'll be 12 or 15 or maybe 20. And then you will have talked to them all for an hour and a half. And when the meeting comes to order, I'll just say, Sib, come on up here and give us a 3-minute talk. And he says, it'll be so easy because you'll just continue to do what you've been doing for an hour and a half, and that's talking to your friends. And he forced me to do that, thank God. And I did get up, and my eyes filled with tears, and my nervous tic came back, and my lip jerked, and that was a terrible thing for me for 3 or 4 months after I got sober. And my voice shook, and I read something out of the book and commented on it. I don't know what. And sat down, and those 25 people gave me a round of applause that lasted to me, it seemed like forever. I felt like I was in the Coliseum. And then I began to smile a little bit, and I thought, my God, was I really that good? If I'm that good, I better go home and read that big book, and I'll memorize a whole chapter, and maybe the downtown mother group will let me talk there someday. And I had to fight that battle. Forevermore, until I went to work in the central office. Oh, sure, I went around with Tex and talked a little bit here and there when I was asked. It hurt, and I tried to cover it up with a phony smile, but yeah, I had to do it because I would regress very quickly and become that frightened, scared person that would sit in the back and maybe drift out into the shadows and die. And it was a long time before I was able to talk. But I was sponsoring people, and I do today. Now, fortunately for me, I'm not as young as the rest of you. I say in this respect, I'm 74 years old. And when Bob gets a new baby, he will say to them, yes, I'll be your sponsor, but I'll have to throw Sybil in with a deal, too. We live in the same house, and they'll say, okay. So, you know, we're told that women work with women and men work with men. But when Bob gets a new baby, I get a share of them. There's one John, there's one Mac, and there's one Gary. And I'm half their sponsor, see? They get 2 sponsors for the price of 1. And I work with women, too. But to my great grief and sorrow, the women that came in the early days didn't stick around very long. And I think I know the reason why. Because I felt the way they did, I'm sure. Alcoholism hadn't been heard of much. For a woman to be a woman drunk and not take care of her children, not keep the house up or do the meal, then disappear for 3 or 4 days at a time and come back and promise never to do it again and then do it again and again and again for 17 years as I did. They were like me, those women, and they were ashamed of it. And it's different now. We were actually so ashamed of it, we couldn't talk about it to each other. And the women didn't hang around. I had very few women that would call me up and say, I want to talk to you about my life. I've got something that's eating at me, and I can't sleep nights, and I haven't told a soul, but I got to talk about it. We didn't do it. We didn't do it. I look back on it, and I think perhaps it's because that my brother Tex was always available, and there was always one woman that I could finally maybe give her just a little idea of what was wrong with me. But these women didn't tell me their stories in depth, and today we do. And I tell almost everything that I can remember about myself from the podium. But we felt really bad that we had been drinking the way we did and that we had lost everything and had lost our self-respect. And we just simply, when called on, would say, my name is Mary or my name is Sybil, and I drank for 17 years, and I'm an alcoholic, and thank you very much. And you just didn't tell them anything, really. And that was a bad thing. It was a very bad thing. But now our lives are an open book. Alcoholics Anonymous is a thing that everyone seems to know about, and they come in at all ages. You've seen kids come in at 12 and 13 years old, and I sponsor one of those. And you've seen others who come in. I met a lady in Englewood Monday night, 83 years old, and she's been sober 30 days. A lovely person. Just a beautiful lady. And I was so glad that I got to see her in her sobriety. And I hope she lives to be 100. That's what I hope for myself, too. But along those days, at the hole in the ground, I was always for the helpless, hopeless, and Tex would sneer at me about that. And he'd say, oh, that phony so-and-so, he'll never make it. Oh, Tex, how can you say that? And then a woman would come along that I'd particularly admire, and I'd say, oh, she's doing a good job. I'm so proud of her. And I'd be taking her to the meetings, you know. And Tex said, I don't know why you can't see it, Sib. She'll be drunk by Sunday. Well, he was usually right. But we had one day that was brought to our house, one of the helpless hopeless. Tony Lubin brought him to my house, and Tex was upstairs in bed. And he was not feeling too well. He'd had this heart condition for a long time, and some days he could be up, and some days he could not. And Tony Lubin brought this guy into my house, into the kitchen, and whispered to me, make him a cup of coffee. He's in bad shape. And I did. And I noticed this guy was shaking so badly that he could not drink that coffee, but he had to put his mouth down to the coffee cup just to get a little of it, you know. And then Tony took him upstairs to my brother. And they talked a while. And then we found out that his mother had made the call, and Tony had gone down to see this boy. And he lived about four blocks from the hole in the ground. But this fellow wouldn't shape up. He would get drunk. And his mother would call up and say, Mr. Adams. She never said text like the others. Mr. Adams, my son is missing again. And Tex would say, don't you worry, Mrs. Watson. We'll find him. And for her sake. He'd tell me, he'd look around at me and say, never mind, Sib, it's for Mrs. Watson I'm doing this. And he would get a couple of guys, and they'd search, and they'd search, you know, and they'd find him, and they'd come dragging him back to the hole in the ground, unwillingly, sort of, and he'd sit there a spell, and then he wouldn't show up, and then he'd get the phone call. Mr. Adams, I hate to bother you, but my son is missing again. And he'd say, Sib, get Tom Murphy and Velta and go find him. And I'd say, oh, Tex, again? He'd say, yeah, promised the lady we would. Can't hurt. We'd go get him and we'd drag him back. And we tried everything. Now, this went on the whole last year that Tex lived. And finally, Tex, in desperation, made this guy the secretary of the... He says, I'm going to make you secretary of the group. Now you've got responsibilities and you've got to stay sober. Well, did he? Well, the last year of Tex's life, he did. Thank God. And Tex got to watch him stay sober. And then Tex left, and this guy stayed sober after that, although I didn't think he would. And he began to think about his life and that it was valuable. He had cerebral palsy, and still has, of course. And he had to him what he thought was a disfiguring eye that had a problem with it. He couldn't close it. And maybe he thought he wasn't handsome. Maybe he thought he wasn't a lady killer. I don't know. But he had ambition, and he had the desire to stay sober, and he went to school at night and went to college, and he took courses. And while he worked as a janitor at the city hall, and he went to school nights. And when he thought he was ready, and this took several years. Now, in the meantime, I'm working in the central office, and a lot of years has gone by, and he has a room down the street at 13th and Union, and we call him up and give him 12-step calls, and he walks. Walks for miles because he can't drive. And we'd give him calls every day. Evelyn would give him one, Carol would give him one, and I'd give him one. He'd walk, then he'd go see him. And he never turned down a drop, whether they were drunk or sober. He didn't care. But he was staying sober. And eventually, after he got his education, he had the desire to get a really fine job, and he went to work for the IRS. And he worked there for many, many years. And this other little thing that touches me that nobody else would pay too much attention to, when he got sober on Christmas, he always ordered See's candy for Tex, and then his widow, and Tex's four kids, and to me, and to my daughter and my son-in-law are here today. They came down from Hollister. Every year, Addie would call me up and say, because she sent us 3 pounds of candy, and still does. I don't know how many gratitude boxes of See's candy, hundreds and thousands of dollars have been spent on that. And Addie will call me up about December the 10th and say, Mama, did you get your candy? No, I haven't, honey. Well, what do you think? Well, I think we'll get it. And we do. Well, the last 5 or 6 years, this guy has been coming to our house for the holidays. He moved to Brawley. He retired from IRS with diplomas and plaques, the most valued employee and everything like that. This helpless, hopeless man. And he's here today. I love him like a brother, and I think of him as a brother. So does my daughter, and so does Bob. And his name is Ty Watson. Will you stand up, Ty, please? I think that's the reason that I'm glad that when anyone calls for help, how can I really judge or know whether they're going to make it or not? I don't know how. I saw one of the questions, when do you fire a sponsoree? And that to me is a baby. And when does the baby fire the sponsor? I don't know. I don't know all those questions. I more or less go by instinct. I just like to give the kindness and the love that was given me, and it isn't in my nature usually to be tough, but I can be. When the chips are down, and I'll think about it long enough, I can be tough if it's a matter of life or death. I'll have to call a shot, maybe the last measure of, I'll have to say it, whether it's good or bad, and be honest about it, and I will say it to a baby if I can just get them, you know, just please get well. And I'll tell them. But it's hard for me to do that because it hurts me, probably doesn't hurt them. But I'm more or less an easy sponsor. But I never want the day to come in Alcoholics Anonymous when I will refuse a call. We don't get as many anymore. And I'm sorry about that. I sort of enjoyed seeing people come to Alcoholics Anonymous in sort of dirty clothes and maybe unshaven. Or a girl with an old pantsuit on and her hair like mine was. I had to wear a turban or a scarf and tuck my hair up under it for a month or two because I couldn't comb my hair. And I looked very bad. And if the girls were wearing their dresses long, mine would happen to be short from the fashion before. And if they were wearing them short, my skirts were long. And if my coat had a rip in the lining, I would get a safety pin and pin it together. And one day, a woman by the name of Alma Majora came over to my house, and she said, do you have a needle and thread? I said, what for? Well, she said, I want to mend your coat before the meeting Friday night. And it nearly killed me to realize, well, here I am, I'm throwing that coat on the back of the chair and had been for several months. I don't care about the rip. I didn't care about myself. And I always told them that I didn't care. When I first came, when Frank Randall came out to see me, and then later on Cliff Walker, I said, I don't care about myself. If I die, that's okay with me. I haven't anything good to remember. I wouldn't be sober now in AA if it wasn't for my baby. She was 7 or 8 years old at that time. And they say, Sybil, don't talk like that. You can't stay sober for a child. I said, I can't. And I said that, you know, and I said it and said it and said it. And, of course, I finally got the drift of it, and I quit saying it. But I want to tell you, a thrill of a lifetime, and this is a strange thing for a member of AA to say, was when I was in Grants Pass a couple of months ago, and Bob called me and said, your daughter just called me and said she got her 30-day chip. She and my son-in-law went to AA the first of April, first week in April, and I didn't even know she drank. That's true. And when Bob told me this good news, because the motel operator said, your husband called and said he has very good news and for you to call him at once. And so I called him, and I said, what's the good news? And he said, your daughter called me and she got the 30-day chip. And there was a silence, because I had to sort it out. When did she woo her? She never lived in Los Angeles with me since she got married. I didn't know what was going on up in Hollister, California, where all the earthquakes are. I knew they raised five kids, and they're both drunks. And so they decided they'd come down this weekend and be here today, which they are. And this is the first time I've ever been in an AA hall with my daughter and son-in-law. That is absolutely fantastic. Is very good news indeed. Do you know what I'm about to do? I'm about to sit down because you know what I like the best of all, outside of listening to Clancy? It's the question and answer period. Would you let me sit down now? I love you so much. Thanks for letting me sit.
In just a moment, I'm going to break you into the discussion groups by the tables and the people that are facilitators are just that, facilitators. What you're going to discuss is sponsorship. I hope that people have been carrying questions around in their mind. We'll let those questions out today and listen to the answers the other people have. It's just a question of sharing. I imagine some people have to go to the bathroom, and I'm not taking a formal break. So as the discussion's going on, go to the bathroom, get a cup of coffee, whatever you want to do. I'll call back for the question part a little later.
I have two.
Be sure you have the facilitator you want to ask the question come up. Would you do it too deep? And one person at the microphone and one right behind them so that we can go as fast as possible. Are there any questions or comments that want to be made? While this is going on, this meeting hall costs money and the coffee and that sort of thing, and a basket will go around, and if you want to contribute, do. I see one now. Can I have a quiet, please? I feel like the guy at the conventions. Which had that big gap. I see someone down here now, so I'll turn the podium over to Clancy and Sybil.
Hi, my name is George Dell, and I'm Malcolm.
Your mic isn't on. That's good.
Hello? Hello? Can you hear me now?
Good job.
My name is George. I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to direct this question at Clancy. Our group talked about the need for a newcomer to share and dump and unload upon a sponsor or on somebody. And basically, we're trying to decide how much of this should go on and how available should a sponsor be to this. The sense of the group was that some of us absolutely need this in the beginning to have anybody listen to us. Some of us are reluctant to talk at all and need to be encouraged to talk about the little things. And, of course, we're testing a relationship or we're developing a point of trust. And, Clancy, I know you sponsor so many people. How are you able to listen to so many people where it takes so many hours?
Well, the people who talk to me new, I have them call me every day. I talk to them every day. When I'm on a trip, I always leave my phone number where I am with my wife. If I'm in Paris or Escondido, some other foreign place. I'll tell you, I have a little opportunity, though, that most people don't have. Over the years, I used to get a lot of heat in the advertising agencies I worked in because I was always tying up the switchboard with these sick neurotics. And that probably is 50% of the reason that I went to work at the Midnight Mission on Skid Row. In addition to being of aid to people, I also got in a place where I had freedom to talk on the telephone. I talk to new people every day. I am not, if it's, I don't know how to say this exactly right, but in my opinion, a lot of people like to whine and talk and whine and talk. There are some people who, I know many people who are just about crazy with two babies because each of the babies want to talk an hour each every day. And over the years, I've developed some sort of, I hope, feeling about that. If someone's got something they got to talk about, I will listen indefinitely. But I usually don't want to listen to a long harangue every day from the same person. What I try to do is give them little techniques to do something about it or to change the feeling. Then after a while, the next day or the day after that, if they haven't done those things to change the feeling, I tell them, I don't want to hear about that until you've tried to solve it. Because some people, And they grow out of it, most of them. But most, there are some people who come to AA who aren't happy unless they're unhappy. And that's a true story, boy. I talk to an awful lot of people, but I have very few long conversations unless something comes up. If they have something that really is a long conversation they want to really hassle out, I'll meet them or I'll see them or they can come down to my office. I spend a lot of time in my office talking to people. But again, I'm not in a business office. It's a business office, but it's a smoothly running business office, and I'm the boss. So I give myself little privileges. And I have most of the people I see in my office are AAs from around Southern California who set up an appointment and come down and talk about something. Not everybody has that opportunity. I didn't have it for 15 years after I was sober. But I understand that. I think that you have to listen and you have to talk. You must somewhere in there make a division between what is unburdening and what is just old crap coming up day after day after day, the same old baloney. And then find some little techniques to give them something to do so they can feel they're doing something about it. I hope that's an answer.
Thank you. How about Sybil?
Same question?
Please.
If a person calls up and they're obviously drunk, I will not just hang up on them. I'll talk to them for a minute or two and with some pleasantry or something. I will not talk to them when they're in that condition. And if they call up about a problem, I don't give them a short answer. I'll give them my time, and I will listen. I'll be a good listener. But it is true that some people will hang on to something, the same thing, forevermore, and never seem to do anything about it. And you can talk yourself hoarse and never get anywhere with some people who enjoy a problem. They really enjoy it, and they want you to talk about it and commiserate with them, but they're not at the point where they want to do anything about it. And in that case, I think we can spot that pretty soon, and I think it's just like sponsoring people. You have to go on to the next one, the one whose life may be saved, and you cannot give all of your time to someone who's obviously not willing to do anything about their problems, the same way that we will do anything for anyone who wants to stay sober, but eventually we have to release them in order to get with it and give our time to someone who's obviously in trouble. So I don't like that, and I will not be unkind to anyone, but you can do it. You can sort of make it known that you're busy or something or other, and you really are, and let it go at that. But you leave them. I try to leave them as a friend, and I can't get tough with them.
I'm Jean. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jean.
Would you discuss sponsoring people that you don't like?
There's one over there. Sponsoring people you don't like really brings out your best qualities. It really does, because you want to make sure, you bend over backwards to make sure that you are giving an AA. I have sponsored over the years a number of people I don't like. My goal is to try to keep them sober, or help them find new things to stay sober. I don't keep them sober. Do things that keep them stay sober. And hopefully, when they become unbearable, they'll get cross with me and get a new sponsor. I would never remand anyone back to drinking because I didn't like them, or say, get out of here. I'd give them my best shot. But, you know, at best, all of us will never rise above basic human being. And human beings are imperfect and fallible creatures. And it's, you just don't have the warmth towards someone that you think is a puke that you do towards someone who seems to be looking for help. But I try to be correct. Some of those people have turned the corner and become, I've got to like them. Some of them, when they finally punished me and fired me, I was just sick with delight. I just... one of the great pleasures of my life. But I think that it does bring out the best in you, because you really then, I mean, it's easy to slip into things, but to really make sure that they are getting the opportunity to change, that brings out the best I got, because I want to, I don't want to say, oh, I didn't do the best job and he died or whatever it might be. I want to give him the best I got, but also when those kind of relationships don't last an awful long time because there's a certain warmth, a certain magic that is not happening. And usually people you don't like, there's some reason you don't like them. And usually the reason is they don't want to do the things or they want to whine or they are negative forces. And I don't know. You got to do the best you can with everybody, but with people you don't like, you got to do better. And hope to Christ they'll move.
I can't add too much to that. I've been fired a few times by women. One called me up one day and said, Sybil, I have fired you as my sponsor. You have been sober so long that you just don't know how I feel. And I want to get a sponsor who hasn't been sober very long because she will understand me. I don't think that you understand me. And so she fired me. And then not long after that, a year or so, another girl called me up and said, I don't want to hurt your feelings, Sybil, but I'm going to get myself a new sponsor. And I said, fine, lots of luck. I wish you well. And I let it happen. But in sponsoring people, it seems to me that there is no hard and fast rule. There'll be something in me that will tell me to say the extra thing or do the extra thing because I don't want to be in the role of not giving them a good shot, a full shot of what I have to offer. And to tell you the truth, I don't know how this is going to sound, but I don't think I've met many that I don't like. I just, honest to God, don't. Because I do. I mean, there's just something about people that I love, most of the members, really. And the rest of them, I try to get along with them the best way I can and not have too much to do with them. I'm talking about members who are sober. But new people are pretty much the same. They're sick, and they have their problems, and maybe they don't want to go to meetings, and you can't force that on them, and they'll drop out, and they will eliminate themselves. But if they don't eliminate themselves, I'll stick with them all the way, regardless of what the personalities happen to be, and I usually learn to like them. And I know that sounds, oh, goody-two-shoes, Sybil, but I can't help it.
The second question our group wanted to ask was, discuss straights and gays sponsoring one another.
What?
Discuss straights and gays sponsoring one another. For instance, a straight having a gay sponsor or vice versa.
I have sponsored a few gay people over the years. It's a difference in the people, not in the sexual persuasion, I believe. I think that I speak only my opinion. I may secretly, deep inside, feel me that I'm speaking for AA worldwide, but I'm required to say that. It is my opinion that some people use homosexuality to flagellate themselves. I don't hear people get up and say, I'm straight. I hear people get up and say, I'm gay, as if to say, almost subliminally seeking some sort of rejection. I don't think it really makes a hell of a lot of difference if you're homosexual or heterosexual or have a thing with sheep. It really doesn't make a hell of a lot of difference. Hell of a lot of difference. The purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is to enable you to do whatever you do with some degree of comfort. I am not terribly concerned. I don't want to hear people get up and give me a half-hour talk on their homosexuality or their heterosexuality. I want to hear about the problems they've had with alcohol, what happened, and what they are like now, and what's happening. Alcoholics Anonymous pretty much is from the neck up. If you take care of that, the rest of it will take care of itself. But if you don't take care of this, nothing's going to be any good in your life. I have seen people who've used the AA podium to come out of the closet.
and they give a long 45-minute talk on a defense of homosexuality. I don't. It makes me want to barf, as it would if somebody gave a defense of heterosexuality. I don't care about that, except as it is something to do with your life. I have sponsored gay people. One or two of them have developed a love for me, which they brought up as a problem. And we've worked through it in both cases, because it wasn't so much a love for me, but it's just that it's what they would call transference in psychiatry, where you fall in love with your psychiatrist because he represents stability and good. And you work through that with your sponsor. I don't know that if AA is what it should be, it doesn't make any difference who is sponsoring whom if you're learning how to live. If you're trying to find a defense for whatever lifestyle you have, and that's your number one goal, then I guess you got to get into a cult of other people, whatever that cult may be. That's why, you know, there's something kind of unfortunate about that, because, for instance, a homosexual person has to live in a predominantly straight world. He better, or she better, find out how to live in that straight world with some homosexuality and not be in a special interest group where you're all so different that you can't stand for a meeting to be over because you go out there and they're all different. In other words, that's why we are many times against special interest groups. We all feel so damn different anyway. To reinforce it in AA is to really be bad. You know, all airline pilots are all musicians or all doctors or all homosexual people or all anything. The thing that makes AA work is that it is a homogenous organization of the world as it is. Some gays and some doctors and some airline pilots and some ditch diggers. And we learn to live in here with each other and little by little learn to live out there with it. As far as the sponsorship is concerned, I suppose it depends upon the personal. One of the reasons I worked very hard at being with the first gay guy I sponsored, I really didn't like him, and I had a terrible antipathy towards homosexuals at that time. And I had to examine myself, and the reason it was because a dear friend of mine was a homosexual, and I got cross with him years ago, and I was drinking, and I screamed at him, and he went home and committed suicide. And after that, I always felt an antipathy towards homosexuals. Once that surfaced and in my talks with my sponsor, I began to realize I've got to do something to make myself feel better about me. So I gave a little special work in dealing with homosexuals, and now I see them as people. It doesn't really make a whole lot of difference. People are people. Just don't make it your whole reason for being your sexual persuasion. Let it be your sexual persuasion, but you have to live in the world as a human being. We have to live at AA as an alcoholic, and Alcoholics Anonymous will make alcoholics like you and me do what we do more comfortably. Thank you.
Comment on that? I would like to comment on that. I have worked very successfully with gays, and I wasn't uncomfortable about it. I worked with one girl, and in fact, I sponsored her for several years. She was without a partner, no affairs going on, and she moved into my neighborhood, and she'd drive by and have coffee, and we would go to meetings together. And after a year or two, or possibly more of that, she called one day and said, I want to come over and talk to you, and she did. And she said, I don't think I've been fair to you, but when I moved into your neighborhood here, I had just broken up a relationship of many years standing with a gal, and I thought I ought to let you know. I said, well, fine, I'm glad you did. And the only thing that I felt at the time, I was sorry she hadn't told me before. And we're very good friends today. And it didn't make a doggone bit of difference. I'm very fond of her. She's a fine member. She's been sober a long time. And then some of the other gays that Bob and I both worked with have been male and couldn't have better friends in my whole life. And it doesn't make a doggone bit of difference. And didn't from the word go. And I'm happy about myself about that because when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had prejudices, not about that, but other things. I was a prejudiced person because of my early upbringing from a very religious family. And I was a little narrow about many things. And I've shed most of that, I think, where it's just as a matter of course. I think here in California that we probably have a greater gay population than in many other states. And happily, from any observation that I've been able to make, they're just integrated into the group and have a group of their own, possibly. I know of one group. They attend that, some of them, and they seem to enjoy it thoroughly, where it's predominantly gay, and I have made talks there for them. And that's okay. And it's just a repeat of what Clancy has said. Alcoholics are alcoholics, whether they're... There's only one kind of alcoholic, and that's male and female. And gays and those that are not gay. And I have no feelings, no bad feelings about it, one way or the other.
You have a question too, Skip? How many others are there? I tried to wind us up at 3:30, and it's after 3:30 now. Is the consensus of the group they'd like to cover the other questions?
Yeah.
Yes? Well, those of you who have to leave, just slip out quietly. Okay, Skip?
I'm Skip, an alcoholic. As we are not doctors or psychiatrists or psychologists, at what point, or do you, as a sponsor, recommend that a person seek professional help?
Professional help.
I would certainly never inflict this answer on anyone else. I mean, I'm not asking you to be at all influenced by it. I'm going to give you my experience. I have never sent an alcoholic for professional help. I believe that if you're well enough to be on the streets, you're well enough to make it in AA. If you give it all you got. If people don't want to do what's necessary in AA, if they are not willing to do it, then I guess they have to do whatever they have to do. But I have never seen anyone who was well enough to not be incarcerated who could not make it if they gave it all they got. And I would hate to play God and tell people, you better go to get professional help, and deprive them of about 95% chance of making AA, I think. I, as some of you know, was committed for an indefinite to life in an insane asylum. I had 40 electric shock treatments, which was the all-time world's record in that part of the country. They told me I would have to take medications as long as I lived because of the intensity of my emotions, and I haven't had a chemical in my body since 1958. Now, but I'm going to tell you, like I heard a little guy say one, it's very touching. I heard a guy talk one night. He was bent over like this, had a humpback and one arm. He said, as you can tell, it doesn't take much of a man to make Alcoholics Anonymous, but it takes all of them. And that's true of guys who are 6'6" and are professional football players. It takes all of them sometimes. I think when you're... The sad thing is, the sad thing is that sometimes people like us think there's a magic answer somewhere. I'm going to sit down, a guy's going to talk for 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 2 days, it's going to be all right. And there is no answer. No matter, because it isn't what you know or don't know that makes you better. It's what you do or don't do that makes you better. AA does not say we're going to straighten out your thinking and then your actions will straighten out. That's what TA says and TM and S and all these places where poor non-alcoholics have to stumble into to try to get help. AA says we will change your actions and over a period of time your thinking will change. In other words, we will teach you how to act like that wall is blue, and goddamn it, that wall will turn blue. But you must act like it's blue on it, even when you don't believe it. And that's, I'm not saying you shouldn't send anyone to professional help. That's an individual thing. But I have never seen anyone, and I see some awful sick people. I'm in a position that most people like you aren't. I see alcoholics die almost every day as part of my job. And if there were any way back, I'm sure they would have found it. But they are willing to do anything except change their actions. They are willing to do anything except change their actions. All the knowledge in the world isn't worth a pitcher of warm spit if you are not willing to change your actions. And this is the only place I know of that's dedicated to that principle. And I think anyone who's well enough to not be locked up has got the best chance right here.
When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I guess I had very narrow views, and I would express them to anybody that would listen. We had a member that I loved so much, and I think of him almost every day. He could make the best talk of anybody I ever heard, and he was sincere about that talk, but he would get drunk the next day. And this went on all the years that I knew him. And it got to where that he would check into a sanitarium. We didn't have any treatment centers. But it got to where that he would call up and reserve a room at the sanitarium and then go out and buy his booze and get drunk. And so he would drink it and go over there and stay comfortable and come back and make a beautiful talk. And then whatever urge came over him, he would leave and he would call up the sanitarium. That's all we had, Bernadette, or there was another one, $35-$50 a week or something like that. And he would check into it. Make his reservation prior to getting drunk. And we loved him, and we could do nothing, and he died. So therefore, when alcoholism became well-known, and now we have treatment centers, the very first time I heard the word treatment center, I was opposed to it. Treatment centers. You see, you're talking to a last gasper who never heard of any help like that. I just got sick. And threw up and got sick and threw up and nearly died and didn't and found AA. And that was the old-fashioned way, just suffer. And so when I heard of treatment centers, I was bitterly opposed. And I'm gradually getting acquainted with people who have been through them and are sober. And my attitude has softened. I said softened. That's all. My attitude has softened. I believe there are people that have to go through that, and I will let them do it, and that's about it. Thank you very much.
I'm Charlene, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. And our group has a question for Clancy. How do you handle sibling rivalry for your time and attention?
Poorly. That is a problem in people in their first year and sometimes even after that. When you sponsor more than one person or two people or three people, and every one of them is convinced you're giving the others more time. And it's like being the father of a family, in a sense. Somehow everybody has to, if you can, make them feel that they're special for what they are and have some special bond. I don't see how anybody could sponsor a number of people and treat them all the same, because they're not all the same. They're different people. You have different... Everyone has a different relationship. I got a lot of kids. I don't think about any two of those kids the same. They're all different relationships that I have with them, hopefully good ones. It's the same way with people. But somehow you got to communicate this to them, and you can't always do it. There seems to be always someone who is grinding because someone else went to a meeting with Sponce and I didn't get asked, and on about that. I guess you just wish him well, and I don't know any way to overcome it exactly, except that as you mature a little bit, you overcome it. But I remember that feeling with my sponsor. I remember that. I used to just make me upset when I would see him be friendly at a meeting and just give me a cursory hello. It would just... Someday you'll be sorry. But you outgrow it. There's a lot of emotions you outgrow, and if you don't outgrow it, you're going to be in bad shape. That's a very good question. I wish I had a very good answer for it, but I really don't have any answer. That's a difficult question, and it happens to people, especially people that come to AA, who's the basic... Their basic stock and trade is insecurity. And it's that same thing I said earlier. Treat me special. Just treat me special. And if you just treat me like one of the gang, that isn't good enough. And somehow we got to survive through that. And just do the best you can. I don't know.
There's only time for one more now. We do have to give up the hall. Margie?
What qualities should a person look for in a sponsor?
What?
What qualities should a person look for in a sponsor?
What qualities should people look for in a sponsor? Well, new cars?
He likes them a new car. I think that the main quality in a sponsor is their sobriety. The quality of their sobriety, not the years of sobriety. I have never, because I was raised that way in AA, you know, you hang on to things that you were told when you were new, whether they're valid now or not. I was told to go out and work with alcoholics when I was sober 15 minutes, and they said, go out and see all these people tomorrow and bring them down next Friday, and I did, and I stayed sober. And that's just the way it is with me. I just think that the... It just doesn't seem to matter to me too much that whether or not that the quality of the sobriety is just there or it isn't. I'd like for you to repeat that question again because I drifted off there. What was that question, Pat?
What qualities should you look for in selecting a sponsor?
That outside of their sobriety, I think that, of course, that women ought to call on women and men call on men. That is important. And there are exceptions to that. As there are exceptions to everything in AA, there has to be. But, I mean, that is the general way that we do it, and we do it successfully. And I think that you approach someone and ask them to be their sponsor because you like the way they're going to meetings, you like the way that they present themselves, and they're sober, and you know that they have a record of sobriety. Now, on the other hand, I think one of these questions said here, if your sponsor gets drunk, what do you do? And sponsors have been known to get drunk. I think that a lot of people, not all of the people, wouldn't just be mean about it and go up and shake their finger at her and say, look here, you've been drunk, so you're out of this whole thing forever. You've been drunk. Well, that's what alcoholics do. I think when a person has been drunk, that for a little time they ought to lay back and think about maybe what caused them to get drunk and then resume their activities in AA and sponsor people and take them to the meeting. I don't think this, and I feel very strongly about this, I don't think that we ought to write down any rules or make any motions and have them seconded and then pass it and put it in written form and mail it out to the groups that you can't make a 12-step call or have a sponsor or do this or that until you've been sober X number of months. The thing is that nowadays, and way up north in Northern California now in some of the groups and across the country, they won't allow anyone to go see a sick drunk until they've been sober a minimum of six months. Now, that to me is just not the way it ought to be. Because I have a sad picture of Bill Wilson sitting there at home after having worked with 75 drunks, and he told Lloyd she's going to quit the whole thing because obviously no one wanted to stay sober, so I'm through with it. And she said, oh, you're a great success, Bill. You've been sober 6 months. And he said, I guess you're right, Lloyd. So then he went to call on Dr. Bob, and Dr. Bob stayed sober, and they didn't even have a name, and they were successful. Neither one of them had been sober very long. So I think that these things apply to me today, and I think that way probably because of it, that we ought not to refuse a 12-step call to someone who is sober and willing to make one if they've been sober 3 months, 4 months, or 5.5 months. A fellow told me at a meeting one night that he'd been sober 9 years. And then he got in bad shape and came back to AA, and when he was sober a few months, he called up and asked for a 12-step call, and they queried him and said, how long have you been sober? And he said, 5.5 months. He said, I need a 12-step call, and they said, call us back in 2 weeks. That can kill people. I think people ought to go out and see a drunk when they feel like seeing a drunk, and if they're a little uneasy about it, take somebody with you, and it isn't that big a deal. We stay sober by trying to help others, and when we quit doing that, I'm afraid a lot of us are going to be drunk. And the qualities of doing that is simply being sober and having a sincere desire to find others like you and bring them to this meeting or to that group. And that's about it, if you're sober and you're sincere about the whole effort. That's about it.
The question, how do you select a sponsor, I think... The best answer I've ever found is to find someone. I recently read an article in the North County Central Office newspaper that was really good on how not to be a baby, written by me. I would say I don't want to pound this analogy into the ground. But you got to be careful. It isn't just someone who spoke at your meeting who glistens as they walk and you think you get some reflected aura. It isn't someone who is really going to be, who seems to have a lot of things and you want a lot of things.
It really boils down to this, the bottom line, everything extraneous to this. Who will I believe when they tell me that wall is blue? That's the bottom line. That's what it is. It must be someone whom I respect. It not necessarily like, but respect, because my life may depend upon believing upon their perception of reality superimposed over mine. Someone asked me at the break, and I just want to answer this one question. They said, why don't you call on slippers when they're drunk? I used to call on slippers when they're drunk, and I know people do it, and I'm not putting it down. I'll just tell you why I stopped calling on slippers. When I was about 3 years sober, I was working a little advertising agency. I finally got a job back. I was working in Pasadena. I bumped into a guy in the AA meetings I'd gone to college with in Wisconsin back in the 1940s. And I was a humanist. I had those old-timers and their goddamn coldness. I was loving and kind to everyone. And this guy, I was going to make him my... When I was living in the back seat of the abandoned car, I had a guy sleeping in the front seat. He never made it, but but I was really all for it. And this guy called me up one night about 3 in the morning. He said, Clancy, I'm terribly drunk. Can you come over and talk to me? You're the only friend I got, Clancy. You've got to help me. And I was just dead tired. But I got up in Pasadena, where I was living, and put on my clothes, and I shaved. And I went over there and sat in Hollywood till 6 o'clock in the morning with that man and held his hand. I said, Dick, it's going to be all right. It's going to be all right. You know him, Bill. Remember Dick that lived down here? It's going to be all right. I'm going to get you through this. It's going to be you and me. It's going to work. It worked for me. It's going to work for you. And I sat there till 6 in the morning. I was just dead. I got in my car, and he went to sleep. I went back to my car to Pasadena. I just got there in time to take a shower and put on my work clothes. And I was exhausted, but it was worthwhile because I had literally saved a human being's life. And I got to work about 9:30. I got a call. It was Dick. He said, Clancy? I said, yes, Dick. He said, I thought you said you were coming over. And a new policy took place in my life. And I think that can be defended on this basis. When a person is drunk, that's not the person you're talking to anyway. A brand new person, maybe. But someone who's been slipping and slipping and gets drunk, that isn't the person you're talking to. You got to talk. The purpose of AA is not to get people sober. If getting people sober is the answer, detoxes would turn out winners. The purpose of AA is to take people and help them to keep from starting drinking. That's the name of the game. That's what we're here for. That's all it's about. I'm glad it works so well for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Clancy and Sybil. Thank you also to Sam, who sits around in the office and thinks up things like this for people like me to do to keep me busy. And I'd like to thank the two speakers, of course, and Bill B. for getting them for us. And the leaders and facilitators, I appreciate the work that you put in this. Mert is somebody who's put a tremendous amount of time in helping to organize this. Mert, would you stand up, please? Kay did that bibliography at the bottom of the of those questions, which I thought was a tremendous amount of work. The setup, people today were Denny and Lori and Jerry and Paulette and Harry C. and Dan. Eileen and Pat made the coffee. Barney set up the PA, and the taping was set up by Bill, and tapes will be available of this meeting. It took a lot of people to do a lot of work to put this on. I personally think it was certainly worth the while in my case. I know that we're going over time, but the cruelest thing that was ever said to me has to be on that question. That's why it's on there about should you sponsor people you don't like. I called Bill after I'd been sober about 4 years and said, this guy asked me to sponsor him and he's just a jerk and I can't stand his guts. What shall I do? And on the other end, there was a long pause and then a slow, quiet laughter built. He was talking about me. I've always remembered that. He had to do it. Why shouldn't I?